So thank you for joining the November PACE session. As you know, there are many familiar faces around, but for those of you who are new, PACE is a collaborative effort, stands for Personalized Assessment and Change Education. That is what it started off with. This is a purely volunteer effort and a collaborative effort amongst our partners, Northumberland Hills Hospital, Northumberland Hills Foundation, the Community Health Centers in Port Hope, Northumberland Family Health Team, IM Care, Loyalist College, and Ontario Health Team of Northumberland, or as we call them, OHTN. So there are a couple of rules in PACE. One is all of the speakers volunteer that their time. The second rule in PACE is that there is nobody trying to solicit, you know, or sell something. This is and the third point is that it is a starting of a conversation. A small group meets once a year, tries to figure out what areas of interest are pertinent around healthcare. The things that we don't talk about is government policy and politics or funding. So this is purely that. We have been now doing this for a few years, and this would be our last one for this year, because in December we take a break. So with that said, I'm going to introduce one of my colleagues, Dr. Francesco Mulay. There he is. He's spotlighted for all of you. So Francesco, you can be on good behavior. Francesco is a colleague. He moved to Northumberland in 2012. He started off, he did a pediatric residency in New York, and then he did an emergency room residency, and then came to Northumberland. He joined us back in 2012, went on to be emergency room physician, and then became the chief of the emergency room, and then went on to do pain and palliative care. We are very fortunate in Northumberland, not just because we have Dr. Mulay, who will speak to us today, but also because we have a fairly good, we have a good number of resources. We have family docs who do palliative care. We have the Ed's House, which is a hospice unit. We have an inpatient palliative care unit in the hospital, and we have the community palliative care team. So there is a significant many providers, and I would say we are really very fortunate that we have that in our community. So Francesco has spoken at PACE before, and our format is pretty much that he has around about 20, 25 minutes. He'll talk about, as you saw in the topic, exploring life and living at the end of life. Some of you had sent some questions. Some of them are very personal questions, so I'll moderate the questions, but feel free to put them in chat or at the end of the meeting or end of Francesco's speaking time, you can come on screen, raise your hand, and we'll moderate those also. With that said, Francesco, over to you. And if I can have everybody mute themselves, which I think everybody is, I'll mute myself too, and so we have no interference. So over to you, Francesco.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mukesh, and thank you for everyone who has attended. Just forgive me if I ask some questions. Can you see the first slide, Mukesh? Yeah? I can't hear you.
Yes, we can see it.
Oh, okay, thank you so much. Excellent. Okay, so I will give this talk based on just various reading, experience, and reflection. And there will be some evidence-based, or at least medical literature supporting points here. any observation I have incorporated into this talk essentially comes from my experience with working with people at this stage of life. And so coming up with the actual title of the talk was quite fascinating, because I never thought I would actually put these words together prior to my opportunity to work with people at end of life. So our goal is to essentially look at this component of life as a stage, okay? Not necessarily as a point to pivot or a point to avoid, okay, or a point to work toward never achieving. At the end of the day, it is essentially an achievement, right? There is some baggage that goes along with that. Many of you have experienced that. I myself have experienced that. But there's one word that I will avoid saying throughout this whole talk. And it would be very interesting to see if anyone picks that up, okay? So, life and living at end of life. Now, this is not my gear, so forgive me if it doesn't flow as well. And it begins, okay. All right. Excuse me one second, guys, sorry. Very good. Excellent. Okay, I figured it out. So, awareness. And many of you might actually be able to relate to it, any of these points that I mentioned here. An individual typically lives to stay alive. That makes sense, right? You seek out help when you feel that your safety and potentially your life is compromised or in danger. An individual will be encouraged or forced to make modifications to sustain life. You invest in self-help, you invest in your physicians and or clinicians with the intention to ultimately change the way you currently live or enhance the way you currently live in order to live as long as you can or live as well as you can for as long as you can. And this third point is the one that I struggle with. An individual may never be encouraged to think about end of life. And that's quite true. Now, there is a bit of an interest in this topic, and there's so many books that have been written about end of life. But in our field, in our business, I come across multiple people that work toward never getting to that point or never having to deal with that point. And I initially start a conversation with the patient. I said, well, have you prepared a will? And most people hopefully say yes. And I said, well, you've already started talking about this actual component of your life. Okay, so now some reflection. An individual's lifespan is decreasing continuously. We know that. There are so many phrases that actually can refer to that. An individual's body is naturally fragile. Well, yes, and we are all fragile in many ways, whether it's a cognitive or emotional or physical component of us. An individual's life expectancy should be uncertain, right? And that kind of makes sense. Many of us know that one day we will approach end of life. We just don't know when that will happen. Many of us will be prepared for it. Many of us will not be. Now, define life. I want you guys to reflect on that for a bit. What does that mean to you? It's quite interesting, actually. There, I've spoken to a number of patients and I've asked them, typically, define life. What is important to you? And many people resort to a number of different responses, of course. And it really depends on the moment where they are in life. So the one phrase, the catchphrase that we tend to use when practicing this aspect of medicine is dignity. And dignity is fascinating because it actually has such a following. And what I have found is that dignity is defined by the individual. Society cannot define dignity. And it kind of has tried to. And many of us essentially try to follow that, right? But it is up to the individual based on that individual's values. So let's make defining defining dignity quite simple. So when it comes to life, essentially everyone wants to maintain some level of independence, and everyone essentially wants the ability to manage any distress. In my business of medicine, I typically approach every patient with the hope of helping them maintain independence and helping them manage some element of the stress that comes on, whether it is the news of a diagnosis, whether it is the symptom that the diagnosis is bringing forth, or whether it is the way the family is responding to what the diagnosis has done to them. So I'm going to come across three options here, and it is a facetious approach. Which option would you choose? I don't expect you to answer it, but I want you to reflect on it. But these three options have been looked at and have been utilized as a way to define a particular trajectory. The gold standard framework is a well-respected documentation of how to approach a patient at end of life. It comes from the UK, and they essentially have attempted to teach a number of physicians or nurse practitioners, clinicians, how to detect when someone is at end of life. And in a little bit, we'll define what end of life means. So this particular trajectory is the one that we see quite often. We see it in the elderly, we see it in the frail. And many of you can probably reflect on a friend or family member that has lived life in this manner. So we look at two things, function and time. Time is just part of that access, but never invest in time. Look at function. So over time, whether it is days, whether it is months, whether it is years, or decades for some people, there is an ultimate change in function. But something happens throughout their life or within that particular time frame, whether it's an infection, whether it's a fall of some sort. And essentially, there's a decline in function. But you can never really focus on time, focus on function. But then there's a new version of that individual, a plateau, if you will, and things go along pretty well until something else happens. Now, you could look at some people and say, yes, once that person fell, once my uncle fell, once my grandfather fell, it was a significant change in the way they lived life. And life essentially is about functioning, right? So how, and there are different components of that, of course. This talk doesn't really focus on that. You have to forgive me for not... There we go. I have two computer screens here. Okay, so organ failure is quite a dramatic term. Okay, but let's think about a diagnosis, a heart failure, a renal disease of some sort, a vascular disease, or COPD. Okay, and again, function and time. So each dip there essentially coincides with an exacerbation, an acute situation based on that one diagnosis. As you can see, function declines after every diagnosis, or after every acute episode that's linked to that diagnosis. This particular trajectory is consistent with a life-limiting diagnosis such as cancer. And someone is doing fairly well, something occurs, and there's a rapid decline. So these three options, okay, are essentially how everyone, okay, will ultimately live their end of life. Sometimes you can have all three. Sometimes you typically have one. It is our job as clinicians to help you understand what to expect once we have a good feeling of which trajectory you fall under. So as you can see, a big component of this component of life might be like a roller coaster ride, a lot of ups, a lot of downs. And again, it's life. And we've helped you define life, right? Life is about dignity, and you define your own dignity. And again, we're trying to maintain some level of independence, trying to help you manage some distress. You have a diagnosis. There's an acute situation. Your independence is compromised. There's some distress. Let's help you get through that. But there is an up and down component, hence the roller coaster. All right. So what are we defining here? So I just talked about three trajectories that an individual can essentially fall under, maybe all three depending. And here we're talking about advanced, progressive, incurable conditions, general frailty and coexisting conditions, an existing diagnosis that increases the risk of an acute crisis. So we're really defining end of life here. This is how we try to define end of life. Now, what about time? Remember I said, don't worry about time. Well, that's almost impossible when you speak to a patient. People are always investing in time. And so this group out of the UK did essentially say that if someone is going to live the last 12 months of their life, well, they're kind of at end of life. But how do we know that? Well, I just listed off. Does an individual have an advanced, progressive, incurable condition? Are they frail? Are there lots of other stuff that's making that patient's life difficult? Is there another diagnosis that puts them at risk of having an acute situation? So those three trajectories coincide with this definition. This is the definition of end of life. We defined what life is. And now we have a definition for end of life. All right, so, but there's one thing that we need to also throw in there, and it's grief. Every time you have a challenge, whether it is cognitive, emotional, physical, existential, or someone you love has a challenge, there is some element of grief. This is what everyone wants to avoid. This is maybe a strong component in the formula for distress. But there are multiple phases of grief, right? And denial is quite interesting because that is the one that I come across quite frequently. And it's sometimes used to label someone. They're in denial. They're not accepting. And it's my job to make those people understand that this is actually quite normal. It's not a choice. We are all blueprinted to experience this. Some of us are better than others. The acceptance part is hard because everyone works towards acceptance, but nobody believes that they'll achieve that. So when I actually help someone define dignity and then maybe help them understand why they're at end of life and then address grief, I cheat a little. I tell people, don't worry about accepting. We can't invest in that. Sometimes there's a lot of energy there that, and it just might not be as fruitful as we hope. But let's talk about what you're experiencing. Denial, anger, depression. There's elements of that that we might have to define in and talk of itself. Talk by itself, excuse me. Okay, so now we're on this roller coaster and there's this diagnosis. There's been quite an effort to manage this diagnosis, but nothing is kind of working. What I've listed off here is common talk. Has my doctor given up on me? We have this drive to always address and treat and cure. It's sometimes hard trying to teach a patient that managing might be more productive. Managing might be more satisfying. It's a different approach. But then we talk about all the other diagnoses that we do manage. Your heart disease, your diabetes, your emphysema. Has my doctor given up on me? A patient invests in that physician. A patient invests in that nursing team. And Now there's nothing more that can be done because we fall into this realm of end of life. But then that patient is forced to change their routine. And they question whether they're going to see that doctor again. And once they start realizing that, okay, this is for real, and I have to deal with this, there is this concept of burden. And then there's this concept of declaring that the individual is not ready. Over time, we do see that a patient who has fallen to that category of end of life finds some meaning, finish some business, tie up loose ends, and establish a new inner circle. And that inner circle might involve a group of physicians, a palliative physician, the family doctor that has now taken on the role as the palliative physician, or nurses that are providing home care. What we eventually witness is growth and adds to that component of life that we have just tried to define. It helps establish a new sense of dignity, a new meaning, a different value. It's a different form of living. It's a different form of independence. And now we can approach any distress that comes a little bit differently. So the next component of this talk is going to bring up some terms that many of you might have come across in reading or in personal care. But it's an opportunity for me to educate people regarding the lingo that might be thrown at you. Or a family member or friend, of course. So advanced care planning, goals of care, and decisions. What I really want to focus on is goals of care. And this is a hot topic. And it is essentially married to shared decision-making, another hot topic in medicine. And goals of care are essentially about helping someone understand where they are, and help them understand what certain decisions they might make. Not everyone is ready to have this conversation, but what I want people to always understand is that these decisions will essentially change. The situation might change, right? The circumstances might change. A response to treatment might change. So ultimately, the goals of care, okay, are fluid. It's very important to understand that. The decision you make today does not mean you have to accept it tomorrow. So will it work for me? Well, this slide is supposed to remind me to mention something. If a patient has been declared to be at end of life and there has been quite a bit of investment in terms of making that patient understand why they are at end of life, and we've already defined what end of life means, and maybe there's a time frame that we can link to it, and we've also helped that patient define life in general, and we're using dignity as our label. How do we preserve life? Or how do we preserve that concept of living? And a very common question that will be asked, because the medical profession has shied away from it and is now understanding the value and the importance of addressing the concept of resuscitation. And this is a very important topic when someone has been declared to be at end of life. And first you have to kind of understand what resuscitation is. And it's a procedure like any other procedure. And when a procedure is offered to an individual, we will initially ask if it will work, and then we will ask if it will hurt. And it is our job to educate people. But now resuscitation is a procedure and is the only procedure that a physician or nurse or bystander does not need that person's permission to initiate. And it is astounding. And the assumption is that everyone wants this. So we need your permission to not do it. And it is imperative that every patient who acknowledges that they have a challenging diagnosis, that they have a different course of life, that they potentially are at end of life, speak to their family, speak to their physician or nurse practitioner about whether this particular procedure will help or will it hurt. And if I'm invited back to give another talk, Mukesh, then I can focus just on resuscitation. Okay. Yeah, sorry, guys. Oh, man. It's not working. There we go. Okay. So what's the job? Well, it's my job, essentially, when working with a patient who is at end of life, is to help the patient and family understand that a different version of care is not giving up. Many times, a great deal of time is spent on managing, containing, controlling a diagnosis, whether it's a heart issue, a lung issue, or a cancer issue. And now there are no options. We've hit this wall, if you will. And another group has to kind of help you at this stage. We just like that last slide, or former slide rather, where we noted that patients sometimes wonder if people are giving up on them or if their physician is giving up on them. Or the physician who promised a lot or team who promised a lot is going to be part of their care. So it is our job to evolve that care and help that patient understand that a version of care that focuses on end of life to help you live better is not giving up. The second point of productive honesty is quite interesting. And it's about listing off what might happen, or if something does happen, this is what we can do. It's very scary. And you have to read the room, if you will, to know if a patient is able to acknowledge that. And you can't do that in 5 minutes. You can't even do that in the first visit sometime. Read the room and be honest about what might be encountered. Values, again, are challenging. Sometimes people have values, you don't necessarily agree with them. But yet, acknowledge what the individual's values are and help them define dignity. Help them essentially understand that this new version of life might require the individual to define dignity at this point of life, which might be end of life. Vulnerability is very, very important to understand. And so back in one of the earlier slides, we mentioned that we're fragile. We are all fragile, no matter how healthy we might present ourselves to be or are physically, cognitively, emotionally. There is a fragility there. There is essentially the potential for a vulnerability. And at this stage of life, it is very important to acknowledge that and address it when necessary. And many times the physical vulnerability is clear. Every time that patient looks in the mirror, they see what has happened to them. They see a progression, an evolution, and so can everyone else. But what has happened to the emotional component? What has happened to the logistical component? Basically, if that person needs more help, can it be provided where they currently are? Can it be possible for the family to be part of that. Vulnerability is a very, very important component of care in an individual at this stage of life. Attaching is, or attachment rather, is a psychology term, and it is very important to know how that patient will attach, in a sense that maybe they're not ready to talk about vulnerability or to talk about issues or what might cause distress. Maybe they need to talk about it every time. This is, for me, as a physician who focuses on this stage of life, this is such a valuable component of life. It's very important to allow that patient to develop the attachment. With attachment comes accessibility, or sometimes distance, depending on the patient. So coping is a phenomenal component of this type of care. Can I help a patient cope? Do you remember when we talked about grief? One of those stages is achieving some level of acceptance, which it's hard to accept something that you've been working your whole life to avoid. But can you cope? So coping is about developing meaning. I am here now, and this is what this is. This is my story. It is quite romantic, okay, if you will, to essentially help an individual understand where they are and what defines them as an individual. Not everyone has the capability to do that, and sometimes we don't have the resources to do it, and sometimes we don't have the time. But yet, working on coping is a very, very strong component, is a very, very important component when helping an individual at end of life. So this is a beautiful field, and imagine this is an individual's life. It is declared as end of life, and would that individual rather be quiet and sit and smell and feel? Would that individual want to have a party there? Or would that individual like to just walk through it? And that has to do with how the individual develops a meaning for where they are at this stage of life and what their narrative is. So it's kind of my job to know what they want to do. And it's not easy. Some people are very good about it. Some people are very prolific. Some people are quite challenged in terms of being able to achieve that. So I've given you the secret. There is a different version of living at different stage of life. One of the challenges and sometimes disheartening things that I get to witness is when that person tries to live the new version of life as if it was the old version of life prior to having a diagnosis that now challenges life. Say that quickly. And can I help that person define a new version of living in this version of life? And sometimes they're forced. Sometimes they're really, really willing to do it. But it is quite fascinating that everyone ends up in the same place. Everyone ends up essentially accepted. And that in itself is another talk that I might be invited to, depending on what you guys think of this one. All right, so these are some of the references or some of the literature rather that I have referred to in this talk and my practice in general. And that is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Francesco. If you can stop sharing your screen, then we'll have folks.
And as you know, Mukesh, that was less animated than my usual talks, right? Confined to this chair.
Oh yeah, Francesco likes to move in the room and talk.
Engage. And so I am sorry that it wasn't as exciting as previous talks.
No, but Francesco has really, touched on a few things. He said define life, but also then define what is end of life. And I had not thought of sharing this, but I'll share with you a personal story. This is about my father. So my father was a professor of medicine. He had his, when he was getting what Francesco defines as end of life, he was becoming more frail. He had a few diagnoses of kidney failure and others as end of life. He knew, as being in medicine, what these diseases meant. And as Francesco said, he did not know how will his stage of life be. My father had three sons who were physicians, and two of them were married to physicians. So there were five of us who could share with him. And he kept asking, he would ask, how will this end? Or what will happen if I don't do something? What would happen if I don't do dialysis? And as my mother, who is a housewife, she came up with what I call, what Francesco just said, productive honesty. She said, oh, that will be the end. It was not how, if you don't do this, this is how it will end. And to him, his words were that I want to die with dignity. And then we had this conversation of what dignity means to you, and the combination of independence and lack of distress, lack of pain, and knowing who you are and being with a different circle of people was dignity. So Francesco, what you just said now all fits in my personal experience many years ago. Mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years ago when my father passed away, is how they carried on. But I had to share that because it just came close to. So questions from folks.
That the one word that I did not say in this talk was dying.
Yes. Right?
And I almost said it, but then I jumped back to my original intention. It's a 20 minute or so talk, and you're trying to kind of focus on so many different components of life in general, but it is very important to understand that this chapter of life, okay, or this component of life, or this stage of life, is still living. But many people are so discouraged, and they ultimately always question, this is not living. Or a family member will say to me, this is not how they would normally live. But it is a new version, and is very important for us to help people say it's okay. And what I said today, just had a conversation with a patient about love, okay, in life, right? And it was about where would end of life be managed. And we were taking into consideration the logistical components that have to be calculated for end of life care. And I said, well, when you came into this world, you needed a lot of love, 24 hours a day of love. And when you leave this world, you still need 24 hours of love, okay? And it hit that person quite well in the sense that he understood, like, oh, so yeah, I could see how it's going to be very challenging, right?
Good. So here are some comments and then some questions. So Kathy Cope said, I love that you refrain from using the word dying. I learned much from you, Dr. Mulay, during the end of life periods of both my parents. So that is a comment. Then here's a question or asking your thoughts from Deborah. Deborah asks, I understand that medical supports are essential at end of life to ease the process of dying. But I think the questions about mortality and death are non-medical. Values, meaning legacy. The larger goal might to become death literate. And wanted you, what your thoughts were about that.
No, and so legacy is actually quite a an interesting term because I do incorporate that into my language. So I always highlight when an individual is trying to declare their legacy, establish their legacy. And like when you meet patients that tend to start giving things away, it's fascinating because this is a way of them carrying on their legacy, something that they found they prized and loved, and now they're giving it to someone else, right? So in terms of death not being a medical term, sorry, can you just repeat that part?
Deborah, if you are online, do you want to ask it yourself? You might be more articulate.
Hi. Yeah, I'm online. Okay. So I really appreciate the presence of palliative care, but I think it's a tall order on the medical profession unless one is trained at, well, obviously palliative care you are, to have at that moment of terminal illness or end of life that all of the aspects of, well, what is life now? Well, actually, I'm dying. And so I have limited time left. Therefore, I want to check in on my values, my legacy. Please, I don't want to suffer very much. Thank you. But that's why I think there's a big piece of non-medical model involved with death. That's all.
Okay. So in terms of dying, quote unquote, I always try to convince people that they're not actively dying when they're at end of life. So I always use this this example. So someone is pregnant and then someone is in labor. And so someone is at end of life and then someone is dying. So again, it depends on how you practice medicine and depends on how you incorporate the system per se. Our palliative care team is phenomenal and skilled at actually looking at that individual who is at end of life and preparing them for the dying process. And it really removes the medicine, if you will. And the medicine that we sometimes incorporate for end of life care is there but not needed, is there and not used. Okay. And I think, you know, your comment is so valuable. This is my link to it. I don't think I could add any more than what you said, because you've actually made a very good point.
Great. Thank you. And there was a question of whether the PowerPoint would be available. So yes, our Loyalist colleagues, the students from Loyalist will put this together, and it will be on the PACE Talks website. So the other one, Francesco, is from Bill Provecki. How do you deal with religious folks and religious beliefs and family members that will not accept a diagnosis and likely not accept end of life?
So I'm actually going to link my answer to this to what we just kind of talked about. And there was a very important word there, suffering. And so everyone, whether they had certain religious values or not, or they have certain moral values that don't necessarily coincide with the team, if you will. Respect their position, respect their choice, and ultimately listen. And that's it. Just listen. And I learned this as an emergency physician in New York. The best physician is the one who can actually put their hands in their pockets and just wait. And so the strength of someone's religious values does not necessarily compromise the care that we can deliver together as a team. And I have had actually a very similar experience not too long ago regarding a patient who was at end of life, but yet the family, because of their religious values, did not want to agree to or acknowledge a do not resuscitate. But yet they knew that the patient was at end of life. And it took me a little bit of time to understand that they did not want to say, it's okay for our loved one to die. And I just listened. And we were of the same religion, but that's not something that I was ever essentially raised with. So just listen.
Great. Thank you. The other question is from Art Seymour. When one's direct family members are at a great distance, how to make them and me feel okay by not having them around? And I'm assuming not around in this stage of life.
Okay, so this is actually quite common, and I address this quite a bit. So pregnancy, labor, end of life, dying. Dying in itself is another lecture. Okay. And helping people understand that the role that they have played in that individual's end of life is when they needed that individual. When an individual, a patient, transitions to the dying component, the true physiological dying component of that stage of life, I always try to make everyone understand that they don't need you anymore. They needed you prior to this. Now, I just don't come across and say that. Of course, right? You kind of develop that rapport and that trust, that camaraderie sometimes, and that ability to communicate. Because there's this concept of guilt that does arise. But being there prior to that stage is essential. And it's okay if you're not there when that person actually dies. They needed you before they got to that point, because everyone dies the same way. But not everyone lives the same way.
So Francesco, here's a question, and see what you think. What if you feel you're dying, but that may not be the case?
So anything comes with experience. So define dying. Okay.
Like when you said you define, you had a definition of end of life. You're becoming frail. You're becoming that. And if you looked at that and they said, well, you know, I'm all of this. Dr. Mule said that, but that is.
Okay. So let's resort to a diagnosis. Okay, let's resort to what a diagnosis actually can do to an individual. And then let's look at function. And of those three options that I jested with, what option would you choose, or what option are you more familiar with, I guess? Function is a strong component. And if someone's inability to function at the level that they think they should, then it's important for us to kind of discern what's causing that. Is there a life-challenging diagnosis, such as diabetes, for example? Or is there a life-limiting diagnosis, such as metastatic cancer? And so work with the diagnosis and work with what the diagnosis has done to you and what has occurred over a certain period of time. Remember the trajectories that I pointed out. Those are very common patterns that everyone falls into. And those all essentially lead to a natural death. And so I think it would be very important for me to help them understand how they got to where they are and then to essentially focus on how they're functioning. And how they're functioning helps me understand how they want to live.
Great. Thank you, Francesco. Make this the last question, and then there are some comments. This one is almost said this might be a talk on its own, but Francesco, it's an important question, so I'll pose it to you. Will Dr. Mule please comment on the pros and cons when someone selects medical assistance in dying?
Absolutely. So there was actually a question earlier that came up regarding that. So I'm glad that it actually did come up during this talk. Medical assistance in dying is a treatment option for suffering, hands down. That individual has to declare that they're suffering. No one else has to agree. It is no one's responsibility to declare that that person who says that they're suffering is not suffering. That person is suffering. It is their legal right to choose medical assistance in dying to treat their suffering. So the problem here is that no one wants to lose someone they love. Now, there could be a religious issue here, of course, right? There could be a redefined moral value here, or there could just be a misunderstanding or a fear issue. So sitting down with family members to understand and helping them understand why this particular loved one has chosen this road is part of my job. But I, again, going back to one of my previous answers, I just listen. And going back to how we declare life and how we define life with dignity, how do we help that individual maintain independence, and how do we address their distress? And if medical assistance in dying is a treatment option for their suffering that is compromising their independence and distress, then that is valuable. And it's my job to at least attempt to educate those spectators. Okay. So in terms of medical assistance in dying and what, you know, how an individual is eligible and how an individual falls under a certain track is another conversation altogether. But it's an option that is that anyone is capable of utilizing. Now, the system is the system and the logistics of the logistics. That's, again, another conversation.
And I think when MAID became legal, the Supreme Court justice, I believe, had said the duty to live does not trump the right of a person to die. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty deep.
I have been fortunate where every case that I have been part of has been one of achievements. Giving this patient the ability to make a decision. They never have the ability to choose whether they want this diagnosis or not, or how the diagnosis impacts them, of course. But now they have a chance to treat what the diagnosis has caused, suffering.
So there, Deborah has posted some book suggestions and also a suggestion of having a series of talks. I'm going to share with you. Thank you, Francesco, for taking the time. And as I said, these are talks that physicians or other providers, interprofessional practice providers, take their time, volunteer their time purely as a service to our community. So I really appreciate it, Francesco, that you did this. I've also shared, Francesco shared about shared decision-making. So the Ottawa folks have a decision aid. This is a framework. It is a two-page thing that you can scribble on. Two people can scribble on, families can scribble on saying what are their values, what are their beliefs, and talk to your care providers as what your beliefs are. Some of us have started using it, and it is quite practical to use. There's a video, and the Ottawa folks have done really good work. Jennifer Gillard also said that there in 2020, Dr. Isak, one of our physicians at NHH, had done a talk on MAID, and that recording is available on the PACE website. So feel free to.
But it is obsolete.
Yes, yes.
I will come back and do another version of it. So much has changed since then.
Right. So clearly, the challenge with these is these are conversation starters. These are point of time conversations. And I hope it starts a conversation. Think about it. Like Francesco said, yes, there are advanced directives. He hopes people have a will, but also having your beliefs known. Because often when we are working in the ICU or critical care areas, families struggle. The biggest struggle I see is they say, I know my so-and-so would not want this, but we didn't have the clarity of conversation. So you telling, or me telling my folks that what my beliefs are may actually help their suffering as we are in our different stages of life. So thank you for coming. I don't see any hands, and it is 6:30. Precisely. So as Jennifer Gillard and Jennifer Gilmer are here, thank you to them, because that is the behind the scenes, the graphics, the links that come out, and we'll have the recording and the presentation of this talk. So you take care, be in touch, be safe. Take care.